Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Unmissable stories from around the globe from the BBC World Service.
My happy place, this is who I am.
Search for the documentary Lives Less Ordinary and Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. We're recording this at 14 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 19th of December. A quarter of a million people flee a new battle in Sudan as the rapid support forces push back the army. Ahead of a vote at the UN, aid agencies voice anger at the humanitarian suffering in Gaza. And we hear about conditions for hostages held by Hamas from a Thai worker who was recently released. Also in the podcast, Iceland witnesses a spectacular volcanic eruption near the capital Reykjavik. And
in the black market, you have the pressure of the police and the neighbours. And in this environment, you have the pressure to perform.
The cannabis growers in the Netherlands going legal. In the 8 months since war broke out between two rival armies in Sudan, at least 12,000 people have been killed and 7 million have fled. Most of the fighting has been centred around the capital Khartoum and in the eastern region of Darfur. Many hundreds of thousands of people sought refuge in a city south of Khartoum called Wad Madani. But that too has now become caught up in the fighting as the paramilitary rapid support forces continue to push back the regular army. Mandeep O'Brien is the UNICEF representative in Sudan.
These have been 8 brutal months of war, which continues to have a devastated impact on children. And we've seen a dangerous escalation of violence since the last weekend with the spread into Madani, that is the capital of the Jazeera state, to which we estimate almost 500,000 people, including children, had fled from Khartoum and Darfur.
Well, over the past 4 days, at least 250,000 have fled Al Jazeera state. Our Africa regional editor, Richard Hamilton, told me about the battle for Wad Madani.
There was a main army base there from the Sudanese armed forces, and it seems that that's been taken over. It's a sign that the RSF, the paramilitary, is gaining more and more territory across Sudan, and particularly they control already 4 out of the 5 main cities in Darfur in the west, and they seem to be moving towards the east. They seem to have more or less taken control of Khartoum, the capital, although that's still contested, and it looks as if the Sudanese army will just end up in Port Sudan. So it's quite significant, and these areas south of the capital were on the main supply route for getting armaments from the south and from the west in Darfur. So it's very strategic, and Wad Madani has a bridge over the Blue Nile as well. And as we were hearing from UNICEF, it was a safe haven for refugees and now it's not. So there's really very few places where civilians can flee to.
And remind us about this force that's on the advance, the rapid support forces, and why they're fighting the regular army.
Yes, so they were created by the former dictatorial authoritarian leader Omar al-Bashir in Sudan before he was overthrown, and he created them as a way of coup-proofing his regime. They were a counterbalance to the regular army. But once he was ousted in a popular revolution and there were discussions about how to go towards a democratic government, then the two sides fell out with each other. And it's basically just been a power struggle for them. And it's now a sort of monster that's out of control. It's the legacy of Omar al-Bashir. And they're the reincarnation of the Janjaweed, who caused genocide in Darfur 20 years ago. And it looks as though they're doing the same thing again. They have very little respect for human rights. And there are allegations, well-founded, that the United Arab Emirates is funding them with military equipment like drones, and that's giving them the upper hand. They've denied this, but analysts have looked at flights coming in from Chad. And the UAE says that these are humanitarian operations, but not many analysts believe that.
And briefly, so from what you're saying, sounds like the army are on the back foot. Are they on the brink of defeat?
Well, that may be a little bit strong, but previously it looked as if this war was going nowhere and that it was a stalemate and that no side would land the knockout blow. So there were hopes that peace talks would result from this stalemate. But because the RSF definitely has military momentum, in a way they have no reason to agree to a ceasefire and the army has no leverage.
Our Africa regional editor, Richard Hamilton. Aid agencies have voiced anger and frustration over the continued suffering of civilians in Gaza as the UN Security Council debates whether to call for a ceasefire in the Palestinian territory. A vote was due to take place on Monday but was delayed to allow time to try to prevent a veto by Israel's ally, the United States. Imogen Folks reports from Geneva.
Aid workers can't hide their despair. A UNICEF spokesman said he was truly furious that Gaza's children couldn't even find safety in hospitals. On Sunday, a 13-year-old girl whose family died in bombing some weeks ago and who had already had her leg amputated was reported killed when her hospital ward was hit by a tank shell. The World Health Organization said it was beyond belief that this should continue. The aid agencies, the humanitarian wing of the United Nations, have said for weeks they cannot do their job without at least a pause in the fighting. But that decision lies with the UN's political wing and its all-powerful Security Council. As with so many other conflicts, like Syria, it seems unable to agree.
Imogen Folks. Meanwhile, one of the Thai hostages abducted by Hamas from southern Israel on the 7th of October has spoken to the BBC about his time in captivity in Gaza. The 37-year-old farm worker said he was fed just once a day, sometimes no more than a piece of bread and a dried date, and lived underground for 51 days. He was released last month and is now back in Thailand, where he spoke to our Southeast Asia correspondent, Jonathan Head.
He's one of a very large number of Thai farm workers who go to Israel. They're absolutely essential to the Israeli agricultural economy. It's a long tradition. He'd only just arrived. I mean, it was his first trip to Israel. He'd only arrived at the end of September, and he'd just been moved on October the 6th to the Kfar Azak kibbutz, which some of your listeners may know is one of the very worst affected by the Hamas attack, with huge numbers of people killed there. And in the morning when the attack started, his fellow Thai workers assured him the gunfire was normal. And as they started to get more concerned and went inside, he's described how the Hamas gunman at that point burst into the room.
I crouched down like this and shouted, "Thailand, Thailand, Thailand," but they kept beating me. All I could do was keep my face down. Another guy trampled on me. I crawled under the bed to hide. I was about to text my wife to say I was being taken, but then they dragged me out by my leg.
One of the real problems this poor man experienced was that he was the only Thai in the group he was held with. And because he'd only just arrived in Israel, he hadn't managed to pick up any other language at all. No English, no Hebrew, no Arabic. And that made his ordeal, which lasted for 51 days, entirely in tunnels underground under Gaza. He never saw daylight the whole time, particularly difficult because he couldn't understand his captors or even speak to his fellow hostages.
During the first 2 weeks, I was like a madman. There was no one to talk to. To be honest, I started talking to myself. I did a lot of thinking. I wanted to ask questions, but I couldn't communicate with anyone. The only way I got through this was by thinking of the faces of my children, my wife, and my mother. I was hungry all the time because we got only one meal a day. I had to sip the water. They gave us one large bottle, which had to last 4 to 5 days, or one small bottle, which had to last 2 days.
And Jonathan, a further tragedy, because he became close, didn't he, or as close as he could do, given the language barrier, to three young Israeli men who were also in captivity and are now dead.
Exactly, and this was a detail we only discovered as we started our interview with him. The news had just broken of the tragic deaths of these three young Israeli men mistakenly shot dead by the Israeli Defense Forces as they finally escaped at the end of last week. He recognized their faces. He was with them almost his entire captivity and used hand signals, whatever he could, to try to get some personal details. He knew that Yotam was a drummer, that Sami, I think he was the Bedouin Arab among them, loved his motorbike. He picked up that he farmed chickens. And he described how every morning they would make a point of shaking hands. They would clap him on the shoulders. And so he is able, even though he couldn't find out much about them, to give a sense of what their captivity was like, because they experienced exactly the same thing as him. Real shortages of food, one meal a day, occasionally very rough treatment, and this absolutely terrifying underground ordeal. They never knew when it would end.
Jonathan Head in Thailand talking to Justin Webb. In many countries in Western Europe, the US and East Asia, more and more people either can't or don't want to have children. A new study of over 2 million people in Scandinavia has found that many of these people may have suffered from a physical or mental illness in childhood. Victoria Uwankunda spoke to one of the authors of the study, Melinda Mills from Oxford University.
What we found was mental health, behavioural disorders, so things related to personality and mood or schizophrenia. And particularly for men, it was actually an increase in alcohol and an alcohol intoxication. And for women, it was related to metabolic disorders. So think if you're diagnosed with obesity as a child or type 1 or type 2 diabetes. So these were really, you know, things we haven't thought about before. We identified rare diseases because you can do that in such a large population as well.
What does that then mean for our future, the workforce going forward, if we are getting less and less children?
Well, it's an interesting question because in many countries across the world, we're experiencing drops in the total fertility rate or the total number of children. So this is really changing many things. It changes things in terms of care. So if we have this increased number of childless individuals, then the state or the country or other individuals in their network have to take care of them. But as you said, you know, in the workforce, if we have an increasing aging population, as we do in Western Europe and in some in East Asia, you have to think about social care, institutional care, and pension systems. So it has really, and transport, I mean, it has really far-reaching implications for societies.
Just to be clear, we're not talking about fertility issues, as has been in the past or how it's talked about, as a reason people do not have children. But this childlessness that we are now looking offers us a broader discussion, would you say?
Yes, definitely. So if you're having up to one-third of people not having children, it can't just be an infertility or a medical factor. There has to be other things going on. So studies have isolated that about 5% of that group, so if it's 15 or 20%, 5% of that are child-free. So they're voluntarily saying, I don't want to have children. But then there's this really large group. So the WHO has said 1 in 6 couples are having infertility issues. So that's why we decided to look at diseases. And we found some really novel things that haven't been found in relation to childhood diseases. So if you had pneumonia or myocarditis or some arthritis as a child, and, you know, we just didn't know that before. And the question is that the disease or is that the medication that was used to be treated for the disease? Or were some people in relation to type 1 diabetes, were some women told, you know, you shouldn't be having children? So there's all of these new factors that the study opened up when looking at such a large population. You know, these early childhood diseases, the medication or the behavior around them, you know, it opens up new areas for research.
Melinda Mills. And still to come on the Global News podcast, No Sledge, the couple who travelled from the north to the South Pole in an electric car.
Their mission is to show how exciting and capable electric vehicles are and to debunk all those myths out there that are currently surrounding electric vehicles.
Something mysterious plagues County Mayo on the west coast of Ireland and its legendary Gaelic football team.
They've come to see the game of the year.
The year is 1951, and County Mayo have just won the sport's biggest prize. But in the midst of such elation, there's a funeral. And for the priest leading the congregation, this sacrilege must be punished. A curse exits his lips.
Damnation be upon every one of you.
It came to pass.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
The US chemicals giant Monsanto has been ordered to pay $857 million to a group of people who said they were exposed to chemicals leaking from the light fittings at an American school. The claimants in Washington state said the discharge affected their nervous systems and hormones. I heard more from our business correspondent, Theo Leggett.
The company that's actually going to have to pay the money here is Bayer, which took control of Monsanto in 2018, and its affairs are now under the Bayer brand. But what happened here was that between 2005 and 2016, students at a school called the Sky Valley Education Center in Monroe in Washington State, so that's quite near Seattle, found that they were becoming ill. They had a lot of different ailments, some of them neurological, some of them affecting the endocrine system. And they ultimately decided that this was caused by PCBs, a type of chemicals that used to be used widely in industry. They were used for products such as caulking, paint, carbon copy paper, in electrical systems. And these chemicals, polychlorinated biphenyls, they were found around the school. So the case was that these chemicals had been making them ill. And in this case, the jury has now decided to award very significant damages, $73 million, and a bit more than that, actually, in this case, compensatory damages and deterrent damages, totaling $857 million. And this is the latest in a series of cases involving students at this school. All told, it's costing Bayer some $1.75 billion if these damages stand.
Yeah, if. So will Bayer appeal against this?
Almost certainly. I mean, we've seen it many, many times in American court cases that when punitive damages are awarded, often those damages are watered down on appeal. So it seems pretty inevitable that will happen. And the firm has said it plans to have the verdict reduced or overturned. It says the outcome has been constitutionally excessive, as it describes it. Also, we should state that on behalf of Monsanto, Bayer said it stopped producing PCBs in 1977. They were actually banned by the US government in 1979. And it says it had warned the school repeatedly since the 1990s that light fittings, which were containing these PCBs, needed to be retrofitted. But it says those warnings were ignored.
Our business correspondent, Theo Leggett. As you may have seen from the spectacular pictures online, a volcano has finally erupted in Iceland after weeks of seismic activity. The latest reports say the lava appears to be flowing away from the only town in the area, Grindavik, which was evacuated last month. Hans Vera was one of those forced to leave the town southwest of the capital, Reykjavik.
As the eruption is now on the north side of this 15-kilometre-long ridge that happened over a month ago, although it's just erupting in the north part of it, they probably think there's a chance that it opens up somewhere else and then it's going to be closer to Grindavik. So I don't see that in the near future they will let people get close to Grindavik. So we are back in the waiting game.
Mike Burton is a professor of volcanology at the University of Manchester. Lucy Hawkins asked him why the volcano had erupted now.
There's continuous magma supply under Iceland, and then there's sporadic eruptions. And so some volcanic activity is inevitable. The question is exactly where, when, and in what form. And we've had a series of eruptions in the last few years from the Reykjanes Peninsula, which is the southwest of Iceland. And this is the latest manifestation. And there was a lot of precursory signals before this eruption. It was obviously ready to go for some period of time. I mean, one of the really interesting questions from a volcanologist's perspective is, what is the final trigger that makes it actually go? But if I'm honest, I think we still don't quite understand what it is which makes it transition into the full eruption.
Mike, the pictures are very dramatic as we see the lava go up into the air. Presumably then it flows down the volcano. Are you able to predict the route it will take or where it could go?
Well, yes, I think there's some very good models now to forecast the propagation of the lava flows once the location of it is known. And obviously, the relief, in a way, of having the eruption begin is that we now know exactly where it is and where it's going. And the good news is that for the time being, it seems the lava flows are not going towards the evacuated populated areas. And there was also some concerns about a local power station, which was key for infrastructure around that part of the island. So for the time being, it looks like the lava flows are going in a benign direction, but they have to keep continuous vigilance because the lava flow could evolve, the fracture could evolve, And so we'll have to just see how this plays out in the coming weeks and
months. When you talk about the evolution, in fact, you just said weeks and months there, we obviously don't know how long it will go on for, and it could be months. What stops something like this?
Well, I think it stops basically when the reservoir of magma, which is driving the eruption, loses pressure. When there's basically, you lose maybe 5 to 10% of the volume of magma, which has been accumulating at depth, when it falls below a certain critical threshold, there isn't enough overpressure to generate the eruption. And so then it just gradually dwindles away. And in fact, what we can use is measurements of the amount of lava being erupted, how that evolves in time. Usually there's an exponential decay curve, which allows us to forecast when the end of the eruption may occur. And so it's too early to say yet, based on this eruption. It does seem that from it looks like the intensity of the eruption is a bit less than it was when it opened up yesterday evening, which is good news. And it's interesting as well, because you can see the morphology changing as the eruption continues. There's ramparts that build up around the fissure, and the activity tends to get more focused. But based on the effusion rates which have been reported, which are about 100 meters cubed a second, this is about 10 times as much as was happening in the previous eruptions in 2021 to 23, but about half or less than half of that which erupted in 2014, 2015. So those eruptions lasted several months. So it's not unreasonable to imagine this will last several months too.
Professor of Volcanology Mike Burton from the University of Manchester. Coffee shops in the Netherlands may be famous for allowing people to smoke cannabis, but using and supplying the drug has long been illegal. The consumption of small quantities has been covered by a police tolerance policy since the 1970s, but it doesn't officially apply to the growth and supply of cannabis, which is dominated by criminal gangs. But this week, for the first time, cannabis is being cultivated legally as part of an experimental scheme that could eventually be rolled out across the Netherlands, as our correspondent Anna Holligan reports.
Inside a large greenhouse, the distinctive leafy marijuana plants are flourishing, along with the cannabis grower, entrepreneur Bart Vollenberg. He's smiling.
Yeah, of course, if you're 24 years waiting on this moment and finally you are legally with plants, never been in this situation, of course, you're very happy that you're able to just be there. The biggest challenge to get here was regulation, all the paperwork that we have to fill in, to get a bank account, to get all the rules back from illegality to legality.
We're now approaching the drying and production room. There are five people wearing white protective suits and turquoise rubber gloves.
And what we're doing here is we're weighing all the wheat in portions of 1, 3, and 5 grams. And then when it's packed, it's ready to go to the shop.
That's Kees Scheffelhout, an organic weed expert. He calls himself a cannabis connoisseur. He's well known in the industry.
You can film. This one is properly tracked and traced, so we can actually put this into the little tubs.
Hundreds of freshly harvested cannabis buds are tumbling into a plastic tub.
We work together with laboratories to analyze our soil, our flowers, and our environment. So these, of course, are three major points that in the black market is not happening. And because we are doing this, we can ensure a high-quality product without residue, pesticides, or chemicals. We have lots of experience. I think with all the people walking around here, we have more than 100 years of experience.
This experiment means the job Case previously kept undercover is no longer illegal.
So the big change indeed, in the black market, you have the pressure of the police and the neighbors. And in this environment, you have the pressure to perform.
The cannabis is sorted by weight into glass jars to keep it visible and free of contamination.
And then we end up here.
Bart Vollenberg.
So this is the consumer packaging. You see the flower in there. And on the other side is a lot of information and a lot of rules and regulations from the government. And then there's a track and trace. So there's a system the government can see where it's coming from. And there's also consumer information. Way too long.
No, I'm shaking my head because it's wow. It's gone full circle from a completely opaque industry to following every tiny step. It's mind-blowing.
In the end, it's all about trust. Can we trust the existing industry to take care of cannabis production and distribution and do it in a transparent and fair and honest way? That's it.
And this was the moment. Europe's first ever legal batch of commercially cultivated cannabis was delivered to a coffee shop and symbolically unsealed by the Dutch health minister. Independent researchers are now monitoring this historic trial with a view to eventual decriminalisation.
Anna Holligan in the Netherlands. Now, anyone who has an electric car will be familiar with what's known as range anxiety, the fear that your battery will run out before you get to the next charging point. But spare a thought for Chris and Julie Ramsey from the Scottish city of Aberdeen. They've managed to drive their rather special electric car all the way from the North Pole to the South Pole. Ben Phillip has the story.
A moment years in the planning. A first-of-its-kind adventure driving pole-to-pole in an electric car.
It's such a relief to finish this expedition. 6 years in the planning, 6 years in the making, and we're finally here. It's a bit surreal to be in Antarctica and to have been at the South Pole, right?
It's exactly that. I mean, what, we've been on the road 10 months, and as Chris says, huge sense of relief. We can't believe we've made history, and it's just absolutely amazing.
Chris and Julie's expedition started in March on Arctic sea ice. The 18,000-mile journey took them through 17 countries from North to South America. Their car, powered by charging points along the way or portable solar panels.
Our mission is to show how exciting and capable electric vehicles are and to debunk all those myths out there that are currently surrounding electric vehicles. Can they work in the cold? Can the batteries work in the cold? Can they drive in the snow? So many questions.
Modifications to the car were kept to a minimum, but bigger tyres were added to help cope with harsh terrain. Chris and Julie are looking forward to a rest over Christmas, but they haven't ruled out more adventures in the future.
Ben Phillip reporting. And that is all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Joe McCartney and produced by Judy Frankel. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.